Well, it's time for us to begin. If everyone would settle in, open your Bibles, the text of Numbers in chapter 30. We'll be continuing in our look into Israel in the wilderness. As we make that transition, let's bow our heads together in prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the privilege to assemble together, to worship together. Thank you for the time we get to share and study. It's our design and prayer that it enrich our faith and draw us closer to you. Help us to be good students, be good listeners, to ask for wisdom from you and to grow our faith. And this prayer we offer in your Son's name. Amen. Alrighty, so as we kind of laid out beforehand, we've got a continuation here of ideas in that earlier on in chapters 28 and 29, there was that shift in understanding from sacrifices from the standpoint of the priest's perspective to now in 28 and 29, the sacrifices were all kind of encapsulated in the worshiper's perspective and seeing that aspect of it. We now move forward into chapter 30 and chapter 31 as ensemble pieces of instruction. And here there are a lot of instruction in chapter 30 on the maintaining of a vow or a promise, because that's a lot of the underlying idea of a vow. A vow is a structured pledge or promise. It's very similar to the instruction that Jesus gives in regards to a chapter in particular, in regards to the same idea in the New Testament, where after dealing with the subject, he says very simply, let your yes be yes and your no be no. In that context, he's trying to dissolve this idea of the strength of a vow, that one vow you are obligated to a higher degree to keep than another. And a lesser vow could be supplanted by a stronger vow. And say, well, no, I've already pledged that over here, so I can't give you this now because I've given it to God or I've given it to this. And so Jesus was trying to diffuse that improper approach to a relationship to God and your commitments. In this case, there's a couple of breakouts for it, and I think it's important for us to consider them because in the context of Israel, in this setting, from before they take the land all the way until the arrival of Christ, and even a little bit beyond, the concept of a vow is integral to the cultures around them. It's really beyond just the religious context we see it here. This was the standard by which they kept their obligations to one another. Today, if you were going to, let's say, take out a loan, buy a house with a loan, or even just buy a house with cash, you're going to sign a lot of paperwork to transfer the deed, to register with the county, to fulfill all of the state and local obligations that might take place. And that's grown. When we did our first home, the list of signatures was pretty small. And our most recent home purchase was not small. Like, I think my arm was a little tired at the end of the process because you sign a lot of documents that go to different places. Those are all structured in such a way to make sure that all parties involved understand the obligations they're taking on. There's actually instruction in all those documents that you kind of blur out eventually. In the context of Israel's setting, they didn't have that. That wasn't their normative behavior. It was, we've agreed to this. And they may signify that vow in a number of ways. Some of them were signified in a written form. But that was less common. More often, you would go before a third party and pledge that vow before a third party. For Israel, who do you think the third party was going to be in the physical sense? Right. God is the overarching authority, but a priest very often would serve as the person signifying it in the cities and even in the temple, especially if the vow became connected to spiritual things. If it was a religiously contextualized vow, like Hannah and her son, there's going to be some religious significance to it. There's definitely going to be some involvement there. Further, in this section, these vows then are balanced on the structure of the honor of God. And so you've raised the bar high enough now that you've invoked God's sovereign capacity as who He is to be a participant in the vow. Is there danger in making that decision, by the way, of bringing God into your commitments? Now, you think about this. In the Old Testament, as just a survey question, were there vows that people made that they regretted afterwards? Well, yeah. And some of them fall into this category of God participating as a participant. Either the request was made through God's sovereign nature, they requested something, they said, God, please grant this request, and if you do, I will offer the first thing that comes out of my house. You know, it's a rash vow, but God was part of it. And once that vow was made, how did He respond, by the way, to the vow? Did He respond with, doesn't matter that much? No, and it actually creates conflict for us, because then what does He mean? Like, we have to figure out what His sacrifice then means, because she's the one who came out first. So then that causes us to understand a couple of things of importance connected to it, not just whatever that sacrifice would be, but why did He value it so much? What was His committed level? Roy, did you have your hand up? Okay. I saw the hand moving over there in the corner of my eye. He valued that commitment so much that even though it was something that hurt Him so much to offer, He still kept it. Now, it's theoretical, and we can think about it in a couple of different ways to kind of break it down. But A, rash in the sense of He didn't count the cost. Rash in the sense of He counted the cost and He assumed that this wouldn't be His price. He counted it with a different ledger. Or any number of other possibilities, but in the end, He still kept it with that same level of vigor. Now that's a great point to make right now before we read the text in conjunction with that earlier reminder of how Jesus dealt with vows. Your yes be yes, and your no be no. If you remove this if-then component to your vow, if you do this, I'll do that, is your yes or no any weaker or stronger? It shouldn't be, right? But we don't treat them that way because we've bargained internally with it too. Like if this happens, then I'll make this great grandiose gesture. You ever seen someone say something like, man, if this happens, I'll read the Bible. How far do they get? Numbers chapter 1. Because they're like, oh, it's another census list, I'm done. You know, maybe. I've seen people do that have come up with, oh, if this happens, then I'll start reading my Bible. And it happens, and they don't commit through it because their yes was independent of that then. Their if never met the contingency of their then commitment and their then statement. All right, so now in the text, we've got the first one that's just the first few verses. We'll start with that. That's verses 1 and 2. Matthew, do you want to read that for us in the back? Verses 1 and 2 of chapter 30. So, in the very simple sense, there is that high ledge of commitment on this point. Like, you got to keep it. You got to keep your promise. Whatever your pledge is, keep it. That should then remind us of a very simple truth. Like we notice with others, if you're going to make a promise, count it. Count it before you say yes. Count it before you say no. No matter what the pledge is, a yes or a no, I'll do this, I won't do that, it will actually eventually meet that conflict to the cost you evaluated. Simona? Right. But you think about it, they're broken out for us as two segments. Jesus says the weight is the same, but one of them is going to have different consequences. If you include the Lord in your pledge, you're saying, all right, Lord, you do as you seem fit, in essence, for the consequences. Especially if you're playing the if-then game. The logical bargaining conversation, but it's not really often bargaining. It's just a commitment level. I'm going to commit to this. And when this happens, then here's the outcome for it. But yeah, they are two separate ideas, but they are so similar because the outcome is you just don't break your word. Whatever that is. And what you say matters. And I'll say it this way, this is from the parent, the child relationship. If you promise something to your kids, you better keep it. Because who's going to call you into account of it before first? The kids. Now, sometimes they're not right in what they remember. But even so, if you say, hey, this is what's going to happen, they are expecting it. Bobby, I got you in a second. They're like literally expecting that promise to come to pass. And they don't care about all the reasons why you can't deliver. He said, if I got straight A's, you said we'd go to Disney World. You might be able to afford to go to Disney World anymore. But they're going to call you onto account about it, right? And that's a good indicator for us to remember how we need to be careful and cautious, but also mindful of the next step of things. Bobby? Well, the answer would be yes. The question is, what did his sacrifice mean? Here's some things that would balance around that. We know that in the only instance where an individual human being was going to be offered as a sacrifice, what did God do? He stopped it and provided it. Further, we also know that on a regular basis, what did the prophets do in regards to nations that we're actually sacrificing children? Did they praise them or condemn them? They condemned them. So human sacrifice really isn't on the table from a standpoint of an idea. But does it specify to us what actually happened? No, it just says... Right, she wept for something, right? And so the next step is... She certainly was given over and was a sacrifice. You talk to someone who is pushed into a direction they didn't plan to go. And this is like a family thing or maybe in this context. You're not going to be like what you thought you were. And what does it mean for him and his progeny? His daughter is not with children in that regard. He sacrifices his own legacy too. Light sacrifice for him by comparison to her, though, I would say, at least from my understanding of the text. And so in a simple sense, with that background information, no, she was not physically sacrificed. She was not put to death. But yes, a sacrifice was made, was my understanding of the text. The reason I say that is I am not convinced that her physical flesh was necessary to keep the vow. Is it a logical option and the possible of all options? Sure, but it doesn't match the rest of the testimony of God. Or he's opposed to it. He prevents it when it's an actual theoretical possibility. And he condemns it in general senses, other words. Her own comments where she weeps further beyond, or further kind of encapsulate that. Also note this. This is an important thing about the Old Testament. We talk about this a couple different times. The Old Testament repeats itself over and over again. It uses the same pictures with the same themes, with the same ideas, and it mixes them up into the context of the immediate peoples. So, like we saw with Noah and Lot, we see that same kind of immorality play itself out. After great wickedness, God's rescue, and then an immediate fall. You can take the sacrifice, if you will, of the future of a child as parallels, and think about Hannah and Jephthah as parallels in that sense, where they're offered up into service. It was not necessarily their intention. It's a repetition of a theme in a broad sense, and they occur again and again and again. One of the reasons that's the case is because we're not that much different. We don't have a tremendous amount of spiritual difference, intellectual difference, or relationship difference with God between Genesis 1 and today, with the sole exception being the completion of God's promise in Christ. That's really the big difference, is that sins talked about being forgiven are future tense at that point, in some senses, present tense, past tense, under the covenant. All right. As included in verse 2, the second facet of that is important to note, and we've identified a couple of that, is that in the end, your word should be worth something. It has value in and of itself. And that's the individual's integrity coming to play, especially in the context of a religiously committed vow, an offer to the Lord. Your word has worth as a sacrifice. That moves us into the next section of the text, which picks up in verse 3. Just like we noted before, in regards to inheritance in a family that only had young ladies as the heirs, and we have a conversation with Moses to solve that issue. We now move into this section, verse 3, we're talking about women and their vows. Again, this is an outlier in the histories of the ancient Near East, where nearly all of the writings that exist of religious practices, nearly all of the writings that exist of secular practices, are male-centric, period. The way in which women are viewed, generally speaking, in the Egyptian, all the way into early Roman context, is women as property. Women as a possession, or women as cast-offs. Especially in the religious writings. They are very secondary, even if you had a female priestess, still secondary in the existing literary baskets. And so for the Old Testament, in God's law, to begin to create standards of both protection and expectation for women made the Old Testament's Israelite goals vastly different than everybody else. It just simply wasn't a thing anywhere else other than the core of Israel as a general principle. Think about it this way. To the history of the Egyptian rulership, it eventually moved into a God/Pharaoh-king concept, where the Pharaoh was literally divine in that role, and there's a male-centric aspect of it. And when, for a brief period, they had a female leader leading Egypt, they had to keep it a secret for many reasons. History bears it out that there actually was a woman pharaoh, but they covered it up through history in order to make everything seem right for that divine line to take place. Even more so, you look at the follow-ons to that and the way in which cultures that bounced off of Judean Christian context, they followed that same stream of thought. But you go back into the Old Testament, and here's another case where God is laying out expectations in an equal way, which is another powerful point to show God's hand as, Israel, you're different. You're not like the nations around you. Here's another way they will not be like them. Verse 5, or verse 3 that is, begins, if a woman vows a vow to the Lord and binds herself by a pledge, while within her father's house in her youth, and her father hears of her vow and her pledge by which she is bound herself and says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every pledge by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father opposes her on the day that he hears of it, no vow of hers, no pledge will by which she will bound herself shall stand. And the Lord will forgive her because her father had opposed her. Now, how does that meet that context? What happens when you turn 18 in the United States? You are legally an adult. Are you smart yet? No, that kind of happens like never. You know, maybe in gradual senses you get a little more wise, but an 18-year-old, you are accountable in an entirely different way. We talk about it in the legal sense as now it's not, you're not a child, an adult, and the consequences shift from juvenile court to big boy court. But even in the sense of obligations, if you sign, then you're obligated to it. Now, that's why when I was a freshman at San Jose State, one of the first things they saw, I remember seeing, was around the quad, day one of classes, they had 5 or 6 different banks that you could sign up for credit cards. Because they were just fishing for as much as they could get. And they wanted my signature. And you talk to Mama, and Mama says, you don't want to sign that. And I didn't know any different, so I said, okay, Mom, whatever. But you think about how that plays out. That's part of what you see here. That in the context of the supervisory role of the home, there's going to be some boundaries for protection. It's a similar principle here played out. And yet, the father doesn't know, doesn't hear about it. The vow still stands. And the clause is given if he opposes it. In essence, if he believes this is a bad idea, a bad plan, and the Lord's going to let it go. That's a rough kind of thing to figure out, too, from the standpoint of the way in which a family dynamic will move in the 1st century or in the 7th century B.C., 14th century B.C., and now. But it's not that different. The Jew, this is a fair conversation. Are there things that you committed to that your parents didn't know about when you were a kid? Yeah. Most of them didn't matter that much. Yeah, I'll meet you after school. Didn't matter that much. Some of them probably mattered a lot. Yeah, I'll meet you behind the schoolyard at 5 o'clock. We'll settle it then. You know, that's a different kind of commitment. Right? At 5 o'clock behind the schoolyard, it's going to go down. If your parents found out about it, they'd hold you back. Like, no, you're not going there. You're not doing that. So we kind of understand that there's some application there in the largest sense. But one other caveat to this, and this is kind of the way to understand it, is this is an expectation for the single woman. Because in the way in which it's framed, if she's still at home under the law's approach, then she's not married. Here's another aspect from culture to tie that in. On the male side of this connection of kind of the shift from dependence to independence, first century Israel and before, when do you think a person would build their own home, like a physical new structure? When would a guy do that? Right when he's about to get married. It kind of brings a layer of physicality to the idea from Genesis chapter 3. Okay, what was before separate are now together. They're going to become a new home in that context. And I think there's some great value to the principle there of understanding that shift in light of these vows as well. And then at that point, those commitments, whatever she had been vowed, would have then been informed in the sense of what her husband would want to know, these obligations, these commitments, which also is something that takes place today too now. If we find folks that are courting, intending to get married, one of the things that takes place is that the minute you sign the I do's, what does it mean about your finances? He does have to pay for college loans. And you have to pay for his. And anything else. That's why a lot of times you hear people talk about being open and honest about those things during that process so there's no surprises. That's part of what you see here too. This is the lowering of the threshold because the father didn't oppose it, but now she goes off to a new home. You think the husband has a right to know what his wife has vowed to commit? To Simona? The son was covered in the earlier verse, too, in a broad sense. Because of the way in which the scriptures are written very often in that same context of a male-centric dialogue. It means the voice is male. It doesn't mean that males are the only ones under consideration. Verses 1 and 2 apply to her. She made the pledge, she had to keep it. But there was a bounce there that her father had an obligation. Also understand it that the financial obligations of any of these vows were definitely going to go through that male structure because that's the structure by which inheritance passed through unless there was an exception. So in as much as there was also this broad responsibility for women in protection in the Old Testament, it wasn't like, all right, you're an independent agent, you're off on your own. God had a design for the family that matches that biblical construct. If you think about the way in which Genesis 3 is framed, it says very plainly at the outset that it was not good for man to be alone, right? I mean, it's like a plain statement. And the solution to the aloneness of man was a companion woman. They were the helpmeets for each other. In a very literal sense, they make each other better. And so that's part of the package of the Old Testament in this instruction process. They are tied together, knit together, sharing together. Further beyond that, you get into kind of places like this. And yeah, at this juncture right here, there's two different standards for what the expectations are going to be. That doesn't mean there's two different values. Are there two different standards of behavior expected in the home? In some senses, yes, because who's the head of the home? Now, from the scriptural perspective, husband is the head of the wife. That's a God-ordained structure order. Christ is the head of all. And so those are things where there's facts of the scriptures. So that also kind of comes across in these various sections where you see, yeah, there's a bit of a difference there. Is it awful? No. Do guys kind of wish they may have had someone to back them up at times? Probably so. That certainly would have been something that would be valuable when guys make stupid vows, and a lot of guys make stupid vows. There probably are some further aspects to this that aren't or germane, but we'll maybe include them in another context. Scooching forward just a little bit, this brings us to verse 6 in the text. And it says there, this shifts it, and we've talked about this already. If she marries a husband while under her vows or any thoughtless utterance of her lips by which she has bound herself and her husband hears of it and says nothing to her on the day he hears it, then all her vows stand. And so you have this similar phrase of a shift of boundary or obligation or a reconciliation point where now in the marital unit, there's going to be another layer. Again, you would have the value of wisdom coming forth. And you might think about it in a very simple sense. In that, these vows could very well have a massive impact on a family. We live in a culture that has the privilege of individual existence. It's possible for someone to live on their own effectively in our culture. From, you know, adolescence to the end of adulthood. Is it good? Generally not. But is it possible? Yeah. In the context of the broad expectations for Israel, living on your own was the exact opposite of what they needed to be doing. Living on the own meant you could not be in a good relationship with God because your sacrifices would be incomplete. You won't be able to participate in the full sense. Passover would not be really Passover for you if you tried to live off on your own. Being excluded was the awful thing. You're cut off from Israel, that's bad. And so you see a level of inclusiveness in these expectations that's also part of the share the information. Share the obligation. Share the expectation. A lot of that comes through in the layers of commitment that would be expected. And in all of that, you're going to see some really important issues eventually need to be grappled with. Because in the end of the text, this is chapter 30 and verse 16, these are the statutes that the Lord commanded Moses about a man and his wife and a father and his daughter while she is in her youth within her father's house. And so there's an expectation that when a woman came of age, there's going to be that shift there. But all of these are designed to help navigate commitments, navigate expectations on both the physical level, but the spiritual level as well. And they are really, lacking variability. There's not like a whole lot of, well, just kind of do what you want and it doesn't matter that much. There's none of that. It's if you make a commitment, you're going to have to keep it. You're going to keep these vows. Any overarching thoughts, Simona? Right, and that goes back to the consistency of headship. Culture today struggles with how to deal with a text like this. Because we live in an environment that is trying to upend the natural relationship of man and woman in the sense of how God designed them. And with that struggled kind of conflicting layers there, you come back with, okay, well, wait a minute. I would, or I feel, or this seems so awkward or strange. But in the end, there's great balance there. Because, yeah, there are some other factors that have to be brought into play. Marital arrangements in this context aren't like they are now. There was a familial commitment, I got you, Tim, that was going to come into play as well. The concept of dowry was still a thing. The concept of the impact of two families being joined together by marriage is still a significant factor. There's a concept of inheritance through which the family expectations of God's blessings would flow through are going to be a factor as well. You get someone who makes a vow of commitment to marriage even. A woman could commit to marry someone. And the father could then come say, no, we can't do that because here's the things that you don't know about this man's family or whatever. These are factors. But the consequences are going to flow through that headship relationship that God built. Tim? Hey. I'm not part of whatever discussion's going on there, so that's your own business. Right, and that's, if you want the balancing clause, you can remember all the wonderful platitudes that exist in Proverbs 31, and especially in the closing sections of the wisdom that comes forth from her, the great insight, the trust that they have. It's not that she couldn't make a vow. It's that and you got the balance to it, that there's going to be some compatriacy to it. They're going to work together in that. And so that's part of it. And you get the great blessings of that as well. I'll say this on a very practical level, on an application level. We no longer live under the old law. But is it wise to consult one another before you make a decision? Now, you want to guarantee a fight at home? Decide something on your own without talking to your family. And it doesn't matter if the family I'm talking about is husband, wife, father, son. You know, talk about big decisions before you make them. In the end, you still might make the same decision, but now you're on the same page. You're on the same team at that point, and the decision is a lot better. And you may learn that you didn't know all you thought you knew about a lot of stuff. Yeah, and that's a more complicated story in that God is using Samson as a judge, and so it doesn't go into great detail as to his motivation at times. We do know he did not consult his parents. What we don't know is that what was driving him was such zeal, specifically to constantly torment folks, including his parents, with his choices. You know, when you get to the point where you're tying animals together with torches, you have gotten your zeal worked up in a big way. And so there's more going on than just his choice of this particular woman in that particular part of God's work, because choosing her from where she was opened up opportunities to engage in further assaults upon the Philistines. Aside from that, the method that he gives as to why he chose her, she looks good to me, not a good metric, not a good standard. It's not the text to go to figure out how to find a spouse. That's going to go wrong for you every single time. So again, you see all of those things lay out. You see how important it is to keep your word. Whether your word is a vow that includes the Lord or not, your personal integrity comes at play. Male or female, the standard is the same in the sense that you still have to keep your vow. For someone dwelling in their father's house, a young lady, the father has an obligation to participate in the decisions and to sometimes say no. And if he says it doesn't say anything, that's him saying yes, and we're going to keep this vow. If that young lady gets married, her husband now takes on that responsibility, that decision-making responsibility that God delegated from the garden forward. And there are consequences to that. We talk about sometimes in culture, oh yeah, it's so great to be the head of the house, you know. Being the man of the house is so great. Okay. What are the consequences? Now, Simona jokingly mentioned one of them where he gets to pay the school loans. Yeah. That's just part of how it goes. And even though there is more equality in economics in our culture in the sense that women and men make sometimes similar amounts, the overwhelming reality is that even in our messed up culture today, men still make more money and pay for more of the things. Especially when they're doing their part to try to build a home that's more biblically balanced. And so that means you're going to be following God's expectations in that role. And you will take on those obligations, knowing them ahead of time as part of God's expectation here. The aspect we didn't really emphasize as much, but I just wanted to hint at real quickly, is that these things should then produce a more harmonious home where things are together. You can see historically in homes where secrets are kept from mom and dad by each other, those homes tend to fracture pretty quickly. One of them had a secret credit card account. You know, one of them had this, or one of them had that, and the other one didn't know. That's the breaking of that harmony, where if they're open and shared, they're usually solved a lot quicker, even if the challenges were bad vows, bad commitments, bad mistakes. Got two questions over there. Simona first, and then Betty. Okay, so Hold on, let me... The first thing, any vow and any binding oath to afflict yourself, and you look at the terminology there, it's a phrase that has to do with fasting versus pain gathering. So the imagery of that Hebrew term is about abstinence from something. Not, I'm going to beat myself, I'm going to abuse myself. It means I'm going to abstain from something. So, right, and that's why you have that's a picture word rather than a legal word. And Hebrew, Proto-Canaanite language, which is the Hebrew of the day, has that pictorial aspect where words have images as much as they have a literal definitional sense, where it means this. So there's this particular word, I think, is one of those word basket things that's hard to translate. So that's verse 13. My translation says it this way. Any vow and any binding oath to afflict yourself, and then the affliction is there to fast as an alternate translation. Linda's got humble. I think there's two other translations. I can't remember if it's optionally. Lexham Bible Translation has a different rendering, and then the CEV has an even different rendering. I can't remember it, so I can't quote it. Deny. And so they're all kind of in that same word basket of abstain from or keep yourself from, which in a broad sense can very well be an affliction, because think about a vow not to have children. Or a vow to maintain your chastity, even after being joined as husband and wife. Would that be something that would be important to share? Well, you know, obviously so. But you think about these are in the realm of all vows are possible. These are things to help you understand commitments that we made. You know, or it could be something as simple as, you know, okay, yes, I vowed that one day a week I'm going to do nothing but pray. Will that affect a person's life? Yeah, certainly will. Betty? They are related significantly. They're connected ideas. Just as much as a woman leaves the home to join in her husband's home status, the husband left his parents' home to join in this new home status. And so they are connected in that sense. They're the underlying reasons for some of the definitions of ideas here. That's it for our time as well, 'cause that's our bell at 7:43. I think that's when this bracket is supposed to end, so we'll try to finish on time for once. But we'll be in chapter 31 Sunday morning. Thanks, everybody.